Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined, of course, by Jeremy Goldcorn, Jiumi. How are you, Jeremy?
I am, once again, exceedingly well. And our luck has returned. The wind blew all the shit out of the air today. So
today we're going to talk about a rather somber and serious topic. Of course, the attacks of January 7th on the headquarters of Charlie Hebdo in Paris. As you point out, not just by Chinese, whether netizens or the party or party-controlled media, but also by China watchers. And so in that endeavor, we have invited along a very dear old friend of both of ours, right? Ada Shen, who has an unpronounceable new married name. Ada Shen, wait, what's your name?
Ribolet Deris.
Yeah, right. Ada. He's been knocking around Beijing nearly as long as you and me, right?
Yeah, Ada and I worked together when starting 97, right?
98.
Beijing scene.
Beijing scene.
She was the art director and I was the managing editor, you know, so we go back a long way.
Worked in film, has worked in philanthropy, has worked doing CSR for Pepsi-Cola. I'm going to, you know, make a preliminary recommendation for anyone who's on Facebook. Follow her stuff, because she's just, I think, for me, just posts the most interesting shit of anyone on Facebook. Just great articles. I can just reliably interesting reads.
I must not have you on my feed or something. I never see, you know, Mark Zuckerberg doesn't want me to read your posts.
You might have blocked me, Jeremy.
Maybe, yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for that absolutely outstanding introduction. I'll pay you later.
Yeah, okay, right.
That's the way it works on the show, Ada. I'm glad you got it. We are in China, in the media business, so, you know.
Predictable.
Jeremy's going to be making a confession on CCTV wearing handcuffs and an orange jumpsuit.
Hey, I remind you, I have a certificate from the Chinese government that I've committed no crime after living here for 20 years. So
you've done your sentence, committed no crime and bad mistakes. I'm in front of a microphone. I feel like, you know, being Freddy here.
Yeah.
So let's get, like I said, this is a somber subject. Are there parallels that you see in the way that Islam is talked about in the Anglosphere, in the Anglophone media, and the way that China is covered?
Well, I think the Anglo-Saxon, the Western media, whatever you call it, I mean, they take a Western point of view, so which is always more sympathetic to the white people, essentially. So in that sense, you know, China, I think, and the Middle East generally get a lot less sympathy from the Western press. The inclination is to first blame the evil commies or the Muslims.
Well, I think that the... I mean, my sense of it was that the attacks were so unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, around the similar time, we had the Boko Haram attacks in Nigeria, right, where you have 2,000 people died, and mm-hmm. you didn't have nearly the same
time. Nothing. It was barely a blip on the news.
And for me, I actually saw the news of Boko Haram show up on my Facebook feed, but I was still so processing what did it mean for terrorists to strike in the heart of Paris. And so the significance of Paris, for me as a westernized Chinese or whatever I am, you know, the significance of Paris, the significance
generic
of...
Generic ABC is what I think.
Generic about. ABC, yeah. Cookie cutter ABC. Yeah, yeah. You know, I think that, you know, I was very much caught up in the sweep, the initial sweep of the shock and the horror of terrorist attack. Executions, basically, is what this was.
They were. Yes.
They were executed. This was assassination. This was execution. And it's different than, you know, it seems a little bit different. I don't think it's different on when it's happening to you, and I don't think it's different when it's happening to someone you love. But in terms of just the shock value, this was shocking. And I think it was equally shocking for everybody. You know,
yeah.
I don't know that the Chinese were saying, well, you know, I think they were also equally shocked because we don't expect this kind of thing to happen in Paris.
Right.
But I think from there, the week subsequent to that, the various narratives and the various questions and the lines of thinking and how do we approach this, you know, je suis Charlie or not, have taken on multiple facets from different perspectives. And it became very complex, I think, very quickly, but in really interesting ways. You have in China a burgeoning sort of Chinese middle class. They have access to the internet. They have access to WeChat groups, different kinds of groups. And, you know, increasingly more have international experience.
Sure.
You know, they have more context for trying to understand what free speech means in the way that the West means it. And still people are having very vigorous debates about what does this mean. And it isn't limited just to China. Of course, in the United States, you know, you have people having different opinions. The New York Times won't run the cartoons. You know, the law, the professor from a journalism school, you know, calls them out saying, you know, you're cowards for not running it. I mean, this is very, very hot stuff for everybody.
Yeah. So let's focus on China now. I mean, I think it's very interesting to see even the variety of reactions within the Chinese netizenry, say, or even within organs of state. I mean, the Xinhua News Agency ran an op-ed, sort of the Global Times, but the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson put some distance between the official government position and what appeared in these op-ed pieces, which was, I think, quite interesting. But let's focus first, bring this closer to home. Ada, you work in an office. You were telling me just before the show that you were chatting with a couple of colleagues of yours. One, if I recall correctly, had been educated actually in Australia, and another in France.
Yes.
And they took very different sides on whether on the appropriateness of Je suis Charlie. Right.
Yeah. Both are young, 20-something, 30-something, early 30-something Chinese women. Both were educated for a time overseas. One had spent some time in France, the other in Australia. And they and their Wang Yo, their internet buddies, had fallen into different camps. And apparently, unbeknownst to me, there had been very vigorous debates going on all week in favor of free press, free speech, Je suis Charlie. Sorry, my love, Emmanuel, for that flub. and the other camp, which is very much opposed, saying that, you know, it's quite foolish to be so provocative time and time again, not wanting to say quite so much you deserve it, but asking the question, could you really be so surprised?
Well, that was exactly what the Global Times and Xinhua editorial said, basically. They said, you know, this shows that freedom of expression has its limits. I mean, that was the... I find it very annoying to read such things in Xinhua and the Global Times, these weaselly editorials.
But here's the thing.
But a lot of people feel that way.
Right.
A lot of people feel that way. In fact, the person who was telling me that they felt that way didn't feel that their particular opinion was helped by the fact that it was sort of the official state position on this as well. They were earnestly and honestly struggling with the idea of what truly free speech without limits would be, and they were saying, of course, there are natural limits to speech.
I'm sure a lot of people are wondering now, you said one's French and one's Australian, and they represent these different camps. Well, one was educated in France and one in Australia, and they fell kind of maybe counterintuitively on different sides of this. The one who was educated in France was espousing the opinion that you said, that they do believe that there should be limits on free speech, that this crossed the line of offensiveness, and this was targeting a marginalized and vulnerable population of North African, specifically Algerian immigrants living in France.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the response to the cartoons is, it takes on different layers when you can actually understand what's in the cartoons.
Right.
And even for humor, it's very, very, very edgy humor. Some people have said that the cartoons are racist or anti-immigrant. In fact, the actual editors were pro immigration and not racist.
Right, they were
devoutly, they were devoutly anti-racist. In fact, I think the editor of Charlie Hebdo was married to a North African woman. But it may be beside the point. I think the point is simply that the nuances are very much a French debate,
mm-hmm.
Which doesn't mean other people can't have opinions about them. But I think then we have to look at our own respective contexts. So
we
yes.
do. But I guess the internet is the game changer in this kind of thing, isn't it? I mean, if you think of like the first time this kind of scandal came to my awareness was Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses, which was when 89, no, late 80s. It was just about the time, 88, 89, anyway.
It was a fatwa declared.
You know, and that was pre-internet, right?
It couldn't have been, Ayatollah Khomeini died in 89. in fact, he died the week of June 4th.
But. So maybe it was 86, 87. Anyway, the listener can look this fact up. but I mean, that was the first time I was aware of, you know, blasphemy in a Western context where we don't give a shit, being taken seriously in another part of the world, and then having, you know, real life danger for the author, Salman Rushdie. And now this phenomenon is on sort of hyper speed because of the internet.
Right.
So, that's, you know, what was just a tiny circulation French magazine that would never, nobody would ever give a shit, you know, suddenly is a global phenomenon.
Yeah.
I mean, and people in Iran can, you know, get offended by something printed in Paris.
But here's the most interesting thing for me is the stuff that I was seeing online. And granted, I'm choosing, right? So it's selective. But I'm seeing people like, there's a political figure named Majid Nawaz. I hope I'm saying that right. And he runs a foundation called Quilliam Foundation. And he very much, and he's run for Liberal MP in the UK. And so I've been following him for some time because I feel like he says really smart things about Islam and the need to reform from within. And he, of course, came out the gate. He was among the first that I saw posting immediately that Islam needs to have a big sit down with itself and talk about reform.
Not an uncommon reaction, actually.
Rupert Murdoch had the same reaction on Twitter,
but it comes differently when it comes out of his mouth.
Yeah, of course, it's Rupert Murdoch. Like a
philosopher, for example.
Also, so to me, I think that's also what's really very interesting is you're seeing, you know, people who have a voice and represent a perspective in Muslim communities in the West saying that, you know, this should not be about blasphemy. This needs to be about anti-terror, anti-violence. In other words, don't get mad over cartoons. This is incredibly foolish. So, and to the extent that, you know, the doctrine, you know, compels you to one position or another, they're taking the position that this must be challenged from within. And so I'm seeing posts and comments by people from all over the world who are Muslim, who are working on those perspectives. And, you know, I think it's just very important to be tracking these kinds of voices, who they are, where they are, how are they supported. I think it's so much more relevant, it's so much more meaningful to the average Muslim person to hear this from another Muslim than it is to be lectured by Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, that's very true. Nobody would like to be lectured by Rupert Murdoch.
Right, but on the other side, there were a lot of people whose immediate reaction, and they may find sort of a common ground with those people who were ready to take Islam itself to task. One of the immediate reactions to this, I think this is embedded in deeply into that George Packer article that was in the New Yorker that came out right away, was that the move, it was a move to kind of reject context altogether, to just say that, you know, the context is there is no context. We decontextualize this entirely. And to someone like me, who is all about that, I mean, that's anathema. I mean, I get that reaction. I mean, my hope is always that they're going to, you know, I mean, be though that once we're done with our full-throated denunciations of this, and once we've made, you know, unequivocally that we don't see anything like, you know, proportionality, nothing ballpark in, you know, proportionality, that we then have that conversation about the context, talk about Algerian communities in North Africa, not just in France, but also talk about the fucking, you know, the Algerian civil war, I mean, the anti-colonial war. I mean, that long, bloody fight. I mean, talk about, because this is weird. It's strange how little people are talking about the specifically Algerian nature of this rather than just Islam. This is an Islamic issue.
Sure, because they don't know it. I mean, you know, how many Americans know about that war, know about that context? Mm-hmm. You know,
they're all kind of Taliban, Osama bin Laden, Islamic State, Saddam Hussein, Ayatollah Khomeini. They're all one person kind of thing.
This is what reminds me of China. This is why it keeps coming back to China for me. It's always like, you know, there's never enough context. I mean, there's never enough, you know, it's impossible to do in, you know, a 1200 word news article.
Well, I think that's what I meant at the start of the show when I said, you know, the Western media is, you know, going to be in sympathy with the Western side of things, and that's the same for China and the Islamic world.
And it's, I'm not just talking about, you know, the apologia kind of context. I'm not just talking about saying, well, you know, I mean, Chinese are like this, or Muslims are like this, but the rest of it as well. I mean,
just, you know, the most basic knowledge.
Right. Most basic knowledge, but also, it cuts in both directions. I mean, like the context for Xinjiang, for example, must involve, you know, a discussion of. I mean, we have to accept that it's most profitably framed in terms of colonialism, and you know that's like a context that many people on the Chinese side of it just refuse to address. It's extremely frustrating.
Do you mean that just as the Muslim world doesn't seem, or at least the perception is that they are not addressing their own issues,
right,
China
exactly.
also has some issues that it just simply refuses to address?
To address that, yeah. That, right. I mean, that it will hide behind context too often. I mean, it's
frustrating. The Guoqing, the national Guoqing, situation.
Exactly. Yeah.
And or the way the Han look at the Xinjiang separatism issue, which they only frame in terms of national security, right? So any issues having to do with, you know, Xinjiang people or, you know, human rights or you know, or
religious freedom
or these other things, they kind of get, you know, they don't really get a fair shake or a fair balance because the narrative of development, the narrative of economic growth, the narrative of one China just sort of flattens all of that. And, you know, it doesn't justify at all violent attacks on innocent people. Okay?
Right.
So this is, you know, we're not talking about justifying that. But what we're saying is, you know, I think what we're saying is there are multiple levels, multiple ways in which different perspectives have a particular interest in their own narrative of what it is they think they see when something happens. And if we don't work at trying to understand how people who are actors or people who are affected communities by these actions or on different sides of these a particular event, if we don't work harder at it, we'll never see it. It could just be Je suis Charlie and, you know, free press, la la, and anyone's against it, it's an asshole. And, you know, and are you satisfied with that? I'm totally not satisfied with that.
Yeah, I'm completely unsatisfied with that. That's why we're having this conversation.
Yes.
Here's another thing. I think this is. You should always do that closer to the mic because it's a satisfying sound. The sound of that beer can opening. So the sound of our conversation getting woolier and. Okay, so let's take this back to China again.
Okay.
One of the debates, and this relate this to Xinjiang and to the issue of Islamic separatism, terrorism in. I didn't put that in air quotes, by the way, in China. One of the big reactions that happened immediately after the attack of January 7th and the couple of harrowing days afterward was, where is our unity march? That whole thing, right? There was a terrific piece that was written by Bethany Allen Ebrahimian and Rachel Liu in the Tea Leaf Nation section of the Foreign Policy. It was a really good, it presented a nice sweep of Chinese opinion about this. And one of the, I mean, it sort of starts off with people who look at this and say, you know, why, where was that outburst of indignation after the March 1st attack of 2014 in Kunming that left dozens dead?
The train station,
terrorist
knives. Right. Yeah.
So I feel like I have quite a bit of empathy for why that would be an immediate reaction for them. But again, it's much more complicated than that.
Well, I think what people see is they, you know, you can compare it in a way to Boko Haram, right? People go, well, where is the world outrage for Boko Haram where there's like 2,000 people dead?
Right.
Okay. But the thing is outrage is not just a function of sort of this idea of like a perfect, objective, human, moral
sense.
No,
in fact, you could probably make an algorithm that would be something like, okay, if the victim is a white American male, you get 10 points.
Well,
if it happens in New York or Paris or London, you get another 10 points. Well, the darker your skin goes, you know, the more points get subtracted. If it happens in Africa, you get like 100 points off. And, you know, you could then have an algorithm to calculate the newsworthiness of something.
Well, I think that's part of it. But
it's not actually adding and subtracting. It's actually
like, right. Sorry, you know, you work at an internet company. I just you know, write things.
I'm actually going to take a slightly different approach to that. And although it's very easy to say that it's just, you know, good old boy racism or good old boy, you know, institutional racism sort of shaping all of this, it's also largely just local governance. You know, if Nigeria is so such a difficult place to be that there are very few journalists who are there to cover the event, that's a factor. If the president, what is his name? Goodluck Johnson, something like
Jonathan.
That.
Jonathan.
Goodluck Jonathan. Thank you. Goodluck Jonathan doesn't even acknowledge that Boko Haram is a problem.
Yeah, okay. Sure.
Well, let's not forget that it was a media outlet that was attacked. I mean, that kind of amplifies it in Jeremy's.
So there's
yeah, of course, yeah, the media outlet, then you get extra points where the coefficient goes up. You know,
sure, it's a media outlet. Yeah. It's Paris. It's a pillar of Western civilization. Yeah. It's, you know.
But also there's an economic fact. You know, I think in Milan Kundera, who I've been referring to more and more often recently, my teenage favorite author, but I think it's an unbearable lightness of being. He has this paragraph that can sound a little bit racist. He says something like, a million Africans can die in Biafra, and it just didn't have a blip, it didn't make any blip on European history. And I mean, it sounds horrible, but it's actually true, you know.
If you're European,
yes. He's referring to the African Civil War in 1972.
Yeah, I think that's what he was referring to, basically. And it didn't really affect anything in Europe. And it's not because of racism, it's because Europe and the US are driving the world economy, and it just didn't affect anyone else, you know?
Yeah, so some of it is structural.
Right.
Okay, so some of it is structural. Even if you want to be like a really good guy and you want to be really progressive and you want to be really fair and you want to be really multiculti and all those good things that we think are good, even if you want to do that, it's really, really, really hard to get outside of these sort of structural limitations that we have. Who reports the news? How is it reported? What are the frames? Free press is like, you know, that is just, I mean, you're asking the press to report on free press? Come on. You know, right. As opposed to, you know, with the attacks in Xinjiang, you know, if you are white Western or just Western, okay, and you've got an attack on the free press of this nature, you're going to react to it. If you are Chinese in China and something like this attack happens at a train station, like to an outside observer, they're like, well, some people died, it was some people with knives, it's another, you know, another conflict. But for Chinese people, it was really, really shocking.
Right.
So it was shocking in a similar way, but it wasn't a way that people outside who weren't Chinese perhaps
also
could really
because
see.
Of the censorship and the you know the very little amount of information the government lets out and the way they kind of deal with it. I mean, there's a blog a Weibo posting that I've referred to previously on some show that was deleted very quickly. I don't remember who wrote it, which basically said, you know, they tell you nothing. You know, it's just a terrible event that happened. They tell you nothing. They tell you it's all solved, and then you must just shut up and believe everything they say. I mean, there's a big difference between the way a reaction happens when, you know, people are allowed to, you know, you can see all the pictures. Everybody's allowed to say what they want, and one where the story is only, you know, you have to follow Xinhua copy only right. in all media, including social media.
But do you know any Chinese people who really just follow Xinhua copy only?
No, but then it doesn't have the same media effect as when people are allowed to freely post their thoughts on Facebook and Twitter.
Agreed.
You know,
that's right. That's
it doesn't have the, so you don't have the momentum building that leads to a unity march.
Well, let's also understand the rationale for wanting to censor this. This isn't, I mean, you would think that it would be in the interest of the Chinese to, if they have it, if the Chinese government has it called that this was an Islamic separatist or a Xinjiang separatist organization with links to the outside, with that they'd want to share this information, right? You'd think that they would want to because it would validate their narrative, right? They don't. Why?
I think they don't for a reason that actually makes a lot of sense to me, which is that I think they think that, like, in the West, you hype the terrorists and then you attract more terrorists. So the way to do it is to just shut down all information and you don't offer people a role model. And I think that, you know, as appalling as that might be, I think there is a certain amount of truth to that.
We're talking about that sort of perverse symbiosis between terrorism and the media.
Yeah, the serial killer is maybe the American embodiment of it, where the serial killer is like, in America, is a figure who's dependent on media coverage, in popular fiction at least. And there is something to that.
There's the other reason too, which is that they have a very, well, a very pessimistic view of the masses in China, believing that there's a very good chance if they let all this information out, as they did in 2009, that there would be pogroms, that there would be, you know, vindictive attacks against innocent Uyghur people, for example, living in
you know, I hope there's a lot of government officials making that argument. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think that's a good side effect of it.
I've heard it directly from somebody I know who works for the PSB. I mean, immediately after 2009, in July of 2009, that, you know, they were most worried about, and that's why they will, for example, prevent you from, why they really prevented people from posting pictures of the Kunming attacks, posting pictures of other terrorist attacks that have happened subsequently, posting pictures of the October.
There was also Tiananmen. A case that I'm remembering. Perhaps you guys can remind me. I think there was a race riot in, it was either Shenzhen or Shanghai, mm-hmm. and it was factory workers who ended up, it was a Han versus Uyghur clash based on, and they came to blows because of a rumor
that a Uyghur had the July 2009. Riots in Urumqi. It happened about a month or so before July.
Oh, okay.
Right. And it was in another town in Guangzhou.
Okay.
Or in Guangdong, rather, in Guangdong.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's this risk that you talk about of the way in which the response is handled, potentially sort of glamorizing and creating even more attractive targets is definitely a real risk. I think the difference between the West and China is also structural. Okay, if you're talking about the press in Europe and in France, you know, this is not only an open press, you've got borders on every side. They're connected to other countries. They're all part of the EU. The EU itself is very connected to a lot of other countries. You know, whereas China, although it shares borders with many countries, the terror problem for China is largely perceived as an internal problem. It's not one that, or at least to the extent that they're cooperating with other surrounding nations around terror or anti, you know, counterintelligence and this kind of thing, it's not public. Mm. It's not a public face of statecraft. Right. So I don't think that the Chinese government sees any national security benefit, and a number one, that would be how they'd think about it. They'd see risk and no benefit to publicizing. That doesn't really help, you know, the cause of a free press, but yeah, it makes a kind
quite
of sense.
Thwart that, right.
Yeah, it makes a kind of sense from where they sit.
Hmm. I feel like I'm a Cassandra sometimes. I mean, that's not the right word for it, but here I am always shouting about the need for deeper understanding of history, for to look at the incredible contingency of all the things that needed to go right for us to have developed this particular Western worldview, and how that is just not the norm for the rest of the world, not the form for the rest of the world, and I know. Though, just realistically, that nobody gives a fuck about history. Nobody is going to study that. Nobody is going to really take that to heart. People are going to be sort of willfully ignorant of it forever, and nothing that I do is going to make a goddamn bit of difference.
Oh,
am I just wasting my
way.
Time? Am I
no.
wasting?
No, you're not wasting your time.
No. So what do we do though? I mean, you know, if we're trying this. Almost implausible experiment here to create these multicultural societies, but when the chasms yawn so fucking wide between, for example, Islam and Western European value systems, between sort of Chinese authoritarianism, and Western values, between, I mean, you name it, how do we fucking do this? How do we? I feel like the American reaction to Charlie Hebdo. I mean, it was really, really interesting, because they would never. I mean, America would not tolerate a magazine like that.
Not in a million.
It would
years.
It's so interesting to see President Obama, just obviously completely torn up of who to send, apologizing for not sending somebody of a higher level, but. Where do you come down if you're an American on this? I mean, how do you, What do you do?
I actually don't really understand why Obama didn't send anybody.
We did send somebody. A very low level.
Sent the French ambassador who was already right there. Right. So, I mean, it's
the
not
U.S.
Really,
ambassador.
The U.S. ambassador in France, right. Yeah. Exactly.
He doesn't actually have power to
no, I mean, Eric Holder
send
was
French
even,
ambassadors about.
Yes, yeah. thank you for that.
despite your activism on his part.
No, I mean, Eric Holder was even in Paris attending a terror conference and he didn't even go. No, it's a little bit inexplicable why Obama didn't exactly respond. And the, you know, White House staffers are sort of taking it, you know, taking mea culpa, you know, for the gaffe. But it's, you know, I don't want to digress, you know, too far from that. I think that these different centers, these different sort of rectifying visions of the various pillars of human civilization, right? Whether be it Western, be it Eastern, be it Middle Eastern, or however you want to call it, I don't know that they reconcile. And I'm not sure that we should try.
That's
okay.
It's depressing. No, we have to.
Well, I think that we need to find common ground. I think we need to find common cause. I think we need to respect common dignity, and we need to respect sort of common, where we have common values and possibility of cooperation. But I think that every place needs its own time to come around to the being confronted by, you know, modernity, the internet, you know, globalization. These are all things that for many places have happened in a very short order of time. I mean, you can see the strain even just within China.
Right.
The strains are incredible. And in a way, people are better off, you know, being a little bit numb because there's just, you know, too much to process.
So do we just shock them out of it? I mean, it's just cathartically just expect them to have a great deal with it event and then I like the American approach. Let me just say that. I mean, I'm going to come right out and say it. I like the overcautious, perhaps respectful, politically correct approach. I think it feels like it may be silly, it may be laughably silly sometimes, but I feel like it's my God, it just seems to me a more enlightened way to do this rather than just the.
Well, I think it's a better fit for China. You know, China where certain formal politeness just makes a lot more sense. But I guess what I'm saying is besides the you know, do we shock them? Do we not shock them? I'm not sure it's up to us, number one. I think
it kind of is. I mean, because we're the ones who hold the power, right? And we're the ones who ultimately decide what these are the rules.
You mean just we who live on this planet now?
We, the sort of, you know, secular moderns, Western secular, westernized secular moderns, as opposed to.
All right. Okay. This is where I think I would like to clarify my point of view on this. I mean, you know, to me, it's like, fuck you, murderers who killed the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists, right? Fuck you, French government, for arresting the anti-Semitic comedian Dieudonné for a Facebook post. Let me finish and we can go into details.
Okay.
The guy wrote a Facebook post saying, "Je suis," the name of one of the killers, and he's a comedian who makes anti-Semitic jokes. So he's now been arrested.
Koulibaly. Yeah.
Right. So fuck you, French government, for that. That is the most outrageous. While all this "Je suis Charlie" bullshit is going on, they arrest a Muslim dude, right?
For not just one.
For making a joke on Facebook about it. Fuck you, French government. Fuck you. Fuck you as much as the Charlie Hebdo killers. You know, fuck Saudi Arabia. Fuck Saudi Arabia. What happened today? This blogger, Raif Badawi, got 1,000 lashes. Can you imagine with a whip? And
he's
10 years in jail.
50 at a time.
Yeah,
right.
It's okay.
50 at a time, whatever. It's okay.
Yeah,
it's great.
Right.
It's like water, you know,
right.
Oh, it's better than waterboarding. Or no, I mean, I think it's much worse than waterboarding. It's torture. You know, what for making a website called Liberal Free Saudi Liberals? That's, you know, they said it was blasphemous or insulted the prophet or something. Fuck you, Saudi Arabia. Fuck you. You know, little fuck you to Global Times and Xinhua for those weaselly editorials. You have no platform to talk about freedom of speech, those two organizations.
Huh.
And, you know, while we're fucking, fuck you, God, Allah, Muhammad, Buddha, Gaia, Krishna, Shiva, Yahweh. Fuck the Pope and the Dalai Lama. Fuck the rabbi of the biggest synagogue in Jerusalem.
Even this Pope?
Fuck the Ayatollah Khomeini.
He's
and
dead.
Baghdadi al-Bakr. Who's the head of the Sikhs? Fuck him. You know, fuck all of them. Let me draw a picture. Let me finish. I'm not going to draw a cartoon, but let me paint a mental image. Let's picture the heads of all the world's religions and all their prophets naked in a big room, smoking dope, snorting coke, drinking wine, and engaged in a group sex orgy. Let's just picture that. Are you offended yet? I don't give a shit. Okay. No one has right not to be offended. I see and hear things that offend me every fucking day.
Yeah.
But you know what? Fuck all of you hypocritical keyboard warriors who think that posting Je suis Charlie is a moral deed or an act of courage. Fuck you. Fuck you all. Where's your outrage when a family of Yemenis attending a wedding gets killed by a drone because some dude in like Arizona made a mistake, you know? Where's your outrage over the arrest of the anti-Semitic comedian in France, you know, the freedom of speech stuff? Remember that? Where's your outrage at the hundreds of thousands? We don't even know how many people have died in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere in the Middle East because of ridiculous policies made and executed by Western governments. So, you know, fuck you all. In terms of who's fucking and who's being fucked, the Middle East and Muslims are being fucked all of the time. And we Westerners are doing a great deal of the fucking. Where's your fucking outrage? All right, that's the end of my rant.
Very good.
It was like a slam.
And you can censor it if you want. I don't mind if that's too outrageous.
I'm not sure there'd be much left if it was censored, my friend.
Okay, I mean, there are a few fuck yous in there that I could get behind, I think. But there are many.
Oh, come on. You're Mr. Gaping Lick the Gaping Wounds of Christ. Like, no, you're so behind many of those fuck yous.
Okay, sure. Okay. You know, that's only when I've had a little too much to drink and I'm feeling particularly blasphemous. Okay. I blast.
Anyway, you can blame that all on me. Send the death threats my way, not to Kaiser. I said it, so that's cool. So fuck you all, right? You got the message.
Right. Yeah. I'm feeling properly fucked now. I think that's a good point to end on for a while and move on to something safer.
Well, I actually would like to make a very quick comment.
Please do.
About Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah.
And I think that part of the point of Charlie Hebdo, if you've seen the cartoons and are trying to struggle with what was the point of these very offensive cartoons, and the point of the cartoons, I think part of it was exactly this: can you be offended by cartoons more than you are offended by the realities underlying them?
Right.
And I think this is their way, very French way, of speaking truth to power in France, in French, and you kind of had to be French to get it. But I think they took that role very seriously.
You know, Ada, I wanted to bring up one more thing. Before the show, we were chatting about, again, this ties it back to China. You were talking about how in medieval Europe, prior to the Renaissance, there was this role, the court jester. And the jester's role was to speak truth to power. And you had actually brought up the fact that in China, such a role existed at some point in imperial history as well. Can you talk a little bit about that? That's something that was kind of new to me.
Sure. I mean, I'm not a China hand, so you know, feel free, China hands, to write in with your corrections and many notes.
You are a China hand. You're not a China scholar. Maybe.
I'm not a China scholar. Yeah. I'm not a China scholar. I'm definitely not a China history scholar. But I did a little bit of, you know, web searching to try and see if there were parallels between the sort of court justice role in...
Which, by the way, is what Charlie Hebdo really was.
Which is what Charlie Hebdo, the sort of tradition of... The tradition of satire and speaking truth to power was you know, in line with this kind of tradition. And in fact, in China, Sima Qian, there's actually, in his histories, there are records of this. And there are a few very famous examples of huaji. I'm actually forgetting the term for it. It's like huaji... Jiazhuang, something like this, but it's and do I know what that means? Not really. I know the huaji part obviously means, you know, comedic.
You're a huaji mei ren.
I'm sort of huaji myself, yes. So you know, and there are examples, you know. So Qin Shi Huang, there was a person. There was also a person named Dong. I'm actually forgetting the name.
Cut
that part. But anyway, so here's an example of the way the jester would work. So the jester was someone who was an entertainer, was actually an actor. And later on, if you meet people with the surname Yo, like Yoshio, the Yo, it's actually often referring to them being actor or from the actor tradition. So and they were they would entertain in the court and they had no power, but they would often consult with the king. They would give advice to the emperor. To help get, you know, and they would speak truth in a way that no one else could. Mm-hmm. So here was an example. It was a very simple example, but apparently there was a king whose favorite horse died, and a person named Yo Meng, was advising the king, and the king wanted to bury the horse in all the regal splendor of a minister because he loved this horse so much. And Yeo Meng knew this was a very bad idea because it would cause all kinds of disturbance with the ministers. But he agreed with the king. He said, "Yes, great king, you should do that. Not only should you bury him in the regal regalia of a minister, you should bury him in the regalia of a king." Uh-huh. And thereby, the emperor realized this was actually a very bad idea, and it would offend all the ministers. And so he buried the king in the horse in the normal way, and then set about working on improving his relations with the ministers. So this is an example
of Chinese passive aggressive behavior.
giving advice.
My mother has studied this.
So there are some examples of this in the past. I don't know if it relates at all, to the current period, or to certainly even up to the modern period, pre-communist or post-communist or any of it. They don't seem to have much of a sense of humor.
Xi Jinping seems more inclined to hire a court sycophant than a jester.
but I think it's important when trying to understand the role of Charlie Hebdo, they were not mainstream. They had
80,000 was their circulation.
60,000. I mean, it's a very small circulation.
It's like as many people as live in our apartment buildings, basically.
Everyone knew it. My husband said that he was very familiar. They knew all the people, the cartoonists. He said that he himself maybe didn't ever get through more than one page of the magazine. He didn't like it, but he respected that it existed and that it had this sort of relentlessly, mercilessly satirical function. And so, regardless of whether or not he personally liked or agreed or even read the cartoons, to him it was very important, and it was very, very much a part of being French. The night of the attacks, he said to me, "This is a blow at the heart of what it means to be French."
This is a part of being French that was really forged in the 19th century when intellectuals were battling daily with the clergy, battling daily
The Republic
monarchy.
Is founded on a separation. So you have this, France actually did away with blasphemy laws, quite early in order to preserve to keep religion and the power of religion, the attraction of religion at bay from secular society. So what Charlie Hebdo were doing was mercilessly continuing to test that limit in terms of, the secular space, in addition to putting a thumb in the eye of racists and extreme right-wing political figures, etc.
Right, and as was explained in a couple of articles that were written today, that's the difference, is that there was no law against blasphemy, but there is a law against inciting to violence, which is why the French police arrested Dieudonné, right? I mean, apparently he incited to violence by posting.
I understand from your and Ada's research that's the case. But I mean, that reminds me of these mealy-mouthed excuses about rule of law when China does something horrible to somebody. I mean, come on, whatever. He put a Facebook post saying, "Je suis," what the hell is the name of the?
Charlie Koulibaly. He mashed up. Very French. He mashed up a couple of things together to make the joke.
Kind of Chinese too, huh? Punny, huh?
Yeah.
So, I mean, a Facebook post gets you arrested. To me, that's outrageous in a week in which people are making such a fuss about free expression. It is the most awful hypocrisy.
Well, the context also is, of course, the attack on the kosher market.
Sure. And I was listening to a BBC News report interviewing a bunch of Jews in Paris and elsewhere in France who, frightened. They think anti-Semitism is on the rise. I understand that argument. But if you're going to make such a fuss about free speech, then fucking, keep the speech free. Make it the same. And, just this is hiding behind a law to me. I mean, the guy it's a cultural comment. It's not inciting hatred Charlie Hebdo is,
And a strong democracy can take it.
Yeah, no one has a right to not be offended, in a democracy. Surely that's the one thing that one should treasure about a democracy. I mean, surely that's I hope. I have dreams.
I have strong reservations about this. I feel like France owes a debt to its former colony of Algeria.
Yeah, but
accepting
then
immigration from there, and then being a little fucking sensitive I mean,
no, that's wrong. That's not what the problem is. The problem is they have to help fix the Middle East or get out of the Middle East.
Punching up is one thing, punching down is another. I mean, I really do feel strongly.
I agree that there is injustice being done to the Middle East and the Middle Easterners and the North Africans, but Charlie Hebdo is not the source of the injustice.
No.
There are economic and military sources of that injustice.
Yes.
That's the question that needs to be addressed.
Well, I don't see them addressing that. I see them punching down.
Okay. Well,
so I wanted.
You heard my rant.
I want to say that I don't really have an answer for that. I basically walk right up to the threshold of here are the reasons and here are the things and here's what happened, and I just don't know. You know, I mean, I can speak for what I would want to see happening in the United States. I can speak for what I hope will happen for all people in France and in China and everywhere. But I can't, it's hard for me to get prescriptive because I feel like the context is so specific. But I am very interested. The only other thing I would say is I think that we have a fundamental tension here between sort of the root causes view, right? You know, what are the root causes for unrest? What are the root causes for why, you know, people are resorting to violence versus the sort of, you know, why don't we agree to deal with people based on who they say they are? You know, which is, they say they're extreme militant Muslims that want to establish a Sharia state, or, you know, that they hate all kafir and they're just out to kill people. So, I mean, I think...
Deal with them as such.
Right? And deal with them as such. So I think that we are collectively around this discussion, be it Charlie Hebdo or be it you know...
Xinjiang
or be it, you know, the derivative events and discussions. I think fundamentally that's the tension, and I don't have an answer.
Let's leave it there and very quickly move through recommendations. I'm already done with mine. I've dispensed mine. Again, once again, follow Ada Shin.
That's your recommendation.
Yeah, no, that's
my
recommendation.
Awesome.
I'm serious. That's my recommendation. You can see now, gentle listeners, that
worship at the Facebook temple of Ada Shin.
Oh, stop.
You know,
you don't even know what I post, Jeremy.
I don't know. I'm just parroting guys. I generally trust them on most things.
There's some really good people on Facebook who actually post stuff that's really worth reading, really worth clicking on.
Right.
Don't waste your time.
Okay.
Jeremy, go first.
So I have two recommendations connected to today's show's theme. The one is a website, mic.com.
mic.com, yeah.
They have it's got a bit of a link baity title, like, you know, you'll never guess how Arab newspapers reacted to the Charlie Hebdo massacre.
I posted that.
Oh, you did? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but it's a bunch of cartoons from, I think, all Arabic or at least all Arabic language newspapers in the Middle East that are not, you know, anti-Semitic or, you know, or pro-terror in any way. You know, they're, so I think you should check that out in the interests of understanding some context.
Oh, that's great.
And a second piece, which maybe Ada, you and your husband would have something to say about, but a guy named Olivier Tonneau, who's a self-described, you know, fairly hard lefty Frenchman, on Charlie Hebdo, a letter to my British friends, but it's also good as a letter to American friends, which, I mean, when you explain some of the context behind it, he also has a particular point of view, which is a lefty, you know, Western European lefty point of view, but it's quite a good read on this affair.
Okay, great. Ada, what about you?
Oh, thank you. I have three recommendations, and they're all reposts from other people. So I'm going to give them a little shout out here. So one is a hat tip to Matthew Stinson.
Matthew Stinson is another person you should follow on Facebook.
Yes, I don't know if he's followable, but he's fantastic.
Well, he's fantastic, even though he's a Republican.
He's a you know, Republican biding his time,
right.
as any good Republican should be right
don't
now.
Don't be prejudiced against any group, all right? Like, you
We're
know,
friends,
you American liberals, you're so comfortable in your own prejudices. You just think it's like totally okay to diss Republicans. That's cool.
Yeah,
you know?
Have you been paying attention at all?
Look.
Okay, my recommendations.
You want me to start my rant again?
My recommendations are, so the first one was from Matt Stinson. He posted a thing from the XX Committee blog, and the article is called Obama and the Global War on Whatever. And basically, it's an operational counterterror intelligence expert saying, you know, making, having a pretty astute dive into the problem of root causes view versus dealing with enemies according to how they view themselves. So that one was very interesting. Another is a hat tip too, Isolde Murillo.
Ah, former guest on our show.
Who's also fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the article is by Thomas Charlton Williams, Chatterton Williams, in N Plus One magazine, and it is called Equal in Paris, and it's on James Baldwin and Charlie Hebdo.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Right, James Baldwin had lived in Paris for many, many years, right, of course.
That's right. And so, and that sort of touches more on racism, what is, what isn't.
And touches on Paris being a freer place than the US of A at that time, you know, for gays and blacks and jazz musicians.
Yes. And the last one is a hat tip to David Wolf. How Not to Fight Anti-Semitism in France, which is an article that appeared in Commentary magazine, which is a pro-Israel conservative Jewish magazine. So I think it's very interesting to me that the most vocal defenders of an even hand with free speech regarding anti-Semitism, saying that, you know, having anti-Semitism special laws that, you know, are directed at anti-Semites doesn't help Jews, doesn't help France.
Hmm, yeah.
So, and David all those Wolf,
also
people
a former
Jewish.
Guest on our show.
Yeah. Oh, great.
And a conservative Republican.
The Zionist.
Right.
You see you guys with your prejudices.
I'm not rooting. We are rooting.
I'm rooting for him. Yeah,
okay, best candidate in 2012 for the GOP slate was Huntsman, and he didn't even draw a polling error. Okay, that is not our fault. That is part of the GOP's fault.
Right. So. Anyway. I would have voted for Huntsman. Well,
I wouldn't have, but I would have liked to see him run.
I think you're a bit of a Huntsman fanboy, Kaiser.
I am a fanboy. Yeah. I like the guy. Yeah. I really like the guy.
I think he's cool. I agree.
You're a fangirl, huh? Gosh, well, maybe you are a little more open-minded than I thought.
There we go. Thanks, folks. Ada, it was great to have you on. And we'll
thanks for
see
having
you again.
Me, guys.
And Happy New Year to you.
Yes, Happy
Jeremy,
New Year.
Rock and roll.
Always rock and roll.
Rock and roll.
We will see you guys next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.